of his work. I will turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 31, and I want to consider just this morning a life. What is a life? Moses is drawing near the end of his days, his sojourn. He's been made aware of that by the Lord himself, and he is giving his final exhortations to the nation. So we begin in verse 1 of chapter 31 of Deuteronomy. And Moses went and spake these words unto all Israel. And he said unto them, I am 120 years old this day. I can no more go out and come in. Also the Lord hath said unto me, thou shalt not go over this Jordan. Now, what is in a life? What does a life ultimately consist of? Why has it been given? What is it for? What really matters when we come to the end of our time here? Well, as often is said, only those things that are done for the Lord will matter. And we're going to look at a life that has been sanctified by God, yielded up to God, been blessed of God, a man who can speak with a confidence, knowing that he has indeed walked with God, not perfectly. Indeed, as you know, he's been forbidden to go into the promised land because of a particular feeling. And you know, when we consider the whole life of Moses, it may seem, still seem, rather strange to us that that one slip should seem to have meant so much. And that last great honor of leading Israel across the Jordan and into the promised land was denied him. Well, of course, we have to remember, and it is a reminder, that because of his position and place, and if any is are indeed elevated to such heights and positions of power and influence, well, even their little sins are magnified. Why God would emphasize that he is infinitely pure, he is infinitely holy. Even to us, what appear the most trivial of sins and wrongs, if they transgress the law of God, merit and deserve death and destruction. And because of Moses' so elevated position, and he dies a man of honor, and blessed, and renowned, and remembered as the great leader of Israel, yet we also remember, as he reminds the people himself, I cannot take you over. I cannot go into the land of promise. Indeed, he reminds them and says, I'm 120 years old. I can no more go out and come in. Well, is he referring to his physical condition? Well, not if you read at the end of the book itself. It tells us that his strength did not dim. Look at chapter 34. And it was quite a remarkable life. And even physically, he was so blessed of God. Look at 34, Deuteronomy 34 and verse 4. And the Lord said unto him, this is the land which I swear unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob, saying, I will give it unto thy seed. I have caused thee to see it with thine eyes, but thou shalt not go over thither. So Moses the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, over against Beth Peor, but no man knoweth of his sepulcher unto this day. Now look at the next verse, verse 7. And Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eye was not dim, nor his natural force abated. He was in quite striking physical condition, even at the end of his days. But he's reminding us, he's not permitted to lead the children into the promised land. But oh, what a life. Overall, and considered, a life of faithfulness and so on. I wonder if at the end of our days, perhaps it's a good point for each of us, good at all times, but perhaps now, to think and reflect upon the life that we have lived up to now. What's it count for? What have we given? What would we take with us? What would our epitaph be? How confident would we be were we, like Moses, given to know you're about to depart? What can we look back on? What can we consider? And you know, we don't have to be Moses or anything like Moses, of course. We're never going to be. But have we been faithful? Have we given ourselves to God? Are there things that we have done that we know he's called us to do? And we've just sought to be faithful. We're weak, we're frail, we don't have great talents and gifts or ability, but whatever we have, you can stand even now at this stage, this point in life, and if you were to depart within the next week, you would know, I tried, I did engage, I was involved. Oh, by the grace of God, oh, I moaned and I groaned and I wasn't always as willing as I ought to have been. But you know, there was a little something and I just did it for him. You may know this account with regards to the great William Carey, probably the father of modern day mission. But he had a son by the name of Felix, and Felix, a professing believer, had promised to be a missionary like his father. In his zeal and perhaps younger days, that was what he was going to be. But William Carey found it necessary some years later, when the world was patting Felix on the back and perhaps many of his peers for his great achievements and success, because he was actually appointed to be the ambassador of the nation to Burma. But William Carey didn't find that something to be proud of. He remembered what Felix had said, what Felix had been determined to be. And so in sharing his concerns with friends and supporters, William Carey requested prayer for Felix. He said, because he has degenerated into an ambassador of the British government when he ought to be serving the King of Kings. That's how Carey looked at it. Many would have said, what an achievement. Nation's ambassador anywhere. Great achievement indeed. No, William was concerned and said, pray for him. He's degenerated. Well, again, perhaps we're not going to be missionaries in the sense of traveling afar and so on. But you know, Charles Spurgeon said, every Christian is a missionary or is an imposter. So there has to be something of the missionary, something of the service of the king, something of evangelism, something in prayer and contribution to the cause of Christ and the advance of the Church of Christ across the world. He said, we're missionaries, even in that lesser sense, just of support, prayer, evangelizing of the young and so on, praying for them, praying for the advance of the Church of Christ worldwide, or indeed, we're just imposters. So what is a life? Well, here we have Moses at the end of his days. And I just want to go through the chapter and bring out some particular, hopefully relevant application and points. So here Moses is giving Joshua a charge. He's to depart the people himself. He speaks saying, I can't lead you, that's not my role. God has that for someone else. Verse 3, the Lord thy God, he will go over before thee, and he will destroy these nations from before thee, and thou shalt possess them. And Joshua, he shall go over before thee, as the Lord hath said. Now, Moses is very deliberately, of course, referring to his successor. Here is the one that will take over from me. He's publicly presenting him, as it were. He's authenticating his successor and the one who will take charge. It is by God's appointment, he reminds the people. He's preparing the way for advance beyond himself. I wonder if in any shape or form we are doing that. We owe it to the next generation. We owe it to our children. We owe it to those that we've been privileged to come into contact with, and we have any kind of influence over or upon. We are to prepare. We are to look to the next and succeeding generation, hopefully to give to them the resources, at least the knowledge and the instruction and the teaching, that they can take the work on. We are here for our little time. Why, if you've been at the Sunday school this morning, I wish I had the list again in front of me. But the little item that we used with the children was looking at the various times in life, what a life consists of, what we spend our time doing in the average 70 years of life. So here was a breakdown of average life, 70 years. 32.9%, the top, let's say 33, a third, spent in your life doing what? Being asleep. Oh, some a little more, some a little less. A third of your life, after all, is spent asleep. What was next on the list, which takes it from the 32.9 to 55 point something percent? Over half of your life will be spent sleeping, or next, what? Working. Secular work, whatever that might be. 55% of your life doing those two things. Then we got into things like sleeping. 8 years of your, sorry, we've covered sleeping. Like eating. 6 years of your life eating. That's all your little snacks and all the breakfasts and lunch and dinners and suppers. 6 years gone, just eating. You break it down. What do they give for religion. Right, bottom of the list. How much of your time or man's time? And remember, when they're doing the breakdown, they're not thinking of evangelicals and true Bible believers and servants of God. So we'd like to think the figure is much higher than the 0.7% they arrive at 6 months out of a 70-year life spent in religion, is how they termed it. But I wonder how much we really spend. Is it significantly more than that? Well, hopefully, yes. If we're true believers, it most certainly ought to be. So Moses is at the end of life. You know, it was split into 3 40-year sections. Being prepared, the middle section, for that 40 years of leading the people across the wilderness. His first 40, as it were, being schooled and educated and prepared by God, then fleeing, and then in the wilderness, learning dependence upon God and experiencing God until that call to go now and lead the children of Israel out. So the encouragement then to Israel in fulfillment or at the end of his service is to give this on, pass this on, look to God. I've proven in myself. They knew that, of course. Nothing like someone that's so experienced themselves, and obviously and evidently so to the people he's speaking to. They knew his faithfulness. They knew his dependence upon God. They knew he had proven God, and God had so blessed him. So as he then says, verse 3, the Lord thy God, he will go over before thee. He will destroy the nations before thee. Thou shalt possess them. Joshua, he shall go over before thee, as the Lord hath said. And the Lord shall do unto them, as he did to Sihon, and to all kings of the Amorites, and unto the land of them whom he destroyed. And the Lord shall give them up before your face, that ye may do unto them according unto all the commandments which I have commanded you. Now Moses can speak like this, and he can be heard, and they can listen, and they can believe him, for he's lived the life. He's walked the walk, not merely talked the talk. Well, if we want to leave a legacy for those behind us, whether our own children or not, whether those that God's, they are those that God has placed in our care, spiritual care, the Sunday school, the young people. Well, it's going to be believable if we have lived, if we have walked the walk, and it's been evident to them, and they see and they hear sincerity. And of course, we have to be with them to show that. Are we drifting? Are we earnest? Are we proving God ourselves? Are we wholly dependent and reliant upon him? Moses can speak from his own experience. So when he says, God will do for you what he's done for me, what he's done for us in the past, he can call upon past experience and of what God has done to encourage them to trust also in the God he trusted in to bring them through their crises, their difficulties. So it's Sihon and Og. Remember them. Remember what God did. Can we speak from experience? Are we avoiding? even the remotest possibility of getting close in service and a walk with God, whereby we would have to prove him. Well, yes, that might save us some heartache and sorrows and griefs and frustration and disappointments. Yes, that might leave us additional time for ourselves and our own desires and habits and interests and pursuits, but we're missing out. We'll miss out ultimately on what really matters, that when you come to that end of life and you're pursuing, or rather considering, what's beyond, and soon it will be the case that you can reflect on a life that was lived for the Lord, where there was denial. And remember, Christ said this was a prerequisite to true discipleship. He said you must pick up that cross, deny yourself, and follow me. They're the ones that die in comfort. They're the ones that die with full hope. They're the ones that die with great confidence. There's been measures of self-denial. They can recall the times when they were so full of fear or even despair, because circumstances, why they were great, they were troublesome, they were difficult, they were hard, but God blessed them and God brought them through. To be able to speak from your own experience. And that's what Moses is doing. And the experience, of course, he shared with others. The Lord gave us victory and he will do the same for you. Could you look your children in the face and say, you know what I face. You know what we've gone through. You know what the Lord's brought us through. You know how we persevered. Well, I want to tell you this. It wasn't in our own strength. It wasn't because we are great resilient people and blessed with such fortitude, or rather produced it ourselves. It was the keeping power of God. And the same God will be here after I'm gone, after we're gone. Children, those under our influence, look to the same God. His power is the same. He's immutable. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. He'll bring you through too. This is what Moses is doing. This will be a delight. What a privilege. What a comfort if you could speak in measure like this. So verse 6, be strong and of a good courage. Fear not, nor be afraid of them. For the Lord thy God, he it is that doth go with thee. He will not fail thee, nor forsake thee. Look at my own life, he might have said. See how good and how faithful God is. Verse 7. And Moses called unto Joshua and said unto him in the sight of all Israel. Again, this very public presentation of his successor and of the issuing of this great charge to Joshua. Be strong and of a good courage, for thou must go with this people unto the land which the Lord hath sworn unto their fathers to give them. And thou shalt cause them to inherit it. And the Lord, he it is that doth go before thee. He will be with thee. He will not fail thee, neither forsake thee. Fear not, neither be dismayed. Why, you can speak to others and comfort them. You can help them most if you remind them that the primary promises of God for his help and his blessing and the experiencing of his power is not merely when you come to the end of life of no service or doing little or nothing and lying in a hospital. No, those that know when the greatest promises are given, always in the context of walking with and serving God. Every occasion, every time, of course in his mercy, of course in his grace, he's with his people always, and he gives us grace that is all sufficient. But the primary blessings of God and the great experiences of God are reserved for those in the context of their walk and service and of bringing glory to Christ. Now, if he's placed you on a hospital bed to do that, well, of course you have his grace and the promise of it. He doesn't expect us to do what we are not physically capable of doing. But you see, here is Joshua receiving this guarantee, this promise of God. He'll be with him. He'll help, he'll encourage him, he'll supply all that he needs. Don't be afraid. It's the Lord that's with you. Then verse 9, Moses wrote this law and delivered it unto the priests, the sons of Levi, which bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord, and unto all the elders of Israel. And Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, in the solemnity of the year of release, in the Feast of Tabernacles, when all Israel is come to appear before the Lord thy God, in the place which he shall choose, thou shalt read this law before all Israel in their hearing. Well, again, the place of God's word in the life of the nation, in the life of the people. And here was a specific occasion that God gives to the people for the reading of his law and his word. Remember, they're functioning under a covenant. It's the covenant of works. That is to be read to them. They were to be reminded of this, the Old Testament people. And what's being referred to is the sabbatical year when the land was to be left at rest. There would be no planting and sowing. Every seventh year it was to be so. God says when that happens, here is a most appropriate time to gather the people en masse to hear the reading of his word and of his law. Show its significance. Show its importance. It's been given to the Levites, to the priests. It was to be within the ark itself. It was to be read publicly on that seventh year. They had the time then, of course, for they were freed from the plantation and so forth for that season. So appropriate times, the reading of the word. We're not under a covenant of works. We're under a covenant of grace. But the law is our rule of life. The word of God, constantly our companion, daily, but specific occasions, reminders of what we owe the Lord in gratitude. Not to earn, not as part of a covenant where we must fulfill certain terms and conditions. It's so here. But as Moses will go on to remind the people and tell them very clearly, God knows how you're going to fail. God knows how you're not going to keep this. Why, says Moses, you've struggled and you haven't done it with my exhortations when I'm present. Now when I depart, you're going to be even worse. Now why would God have Moses do this? Why poor Joshua must have been standing there receiving these promises of wonderful help from God, then hearing from Moses' own lips what the people will do when he is departed. He's Moses' successor. He's going to be there. Of course, it will go way beyond Joshua. It will run throughout the Old Testament era. And why it's been given and why this is emphasized and why emphasized by successive prophets to the people was to constantly drive them to the necessity, to the awareness, there's another covenant running. There's another method, there's another way. And it's this covenant of grace. It's what God will enable you to do when you enter the right relationship with him. So perhaps there are those profess, but they're not truly converted. And what they're living under, and when they hear of dedication and the service of God and so forth, they start thinking like those that are under a covenant of works. And it all seems like work, work, work to them. But you see, if they were in a right relationship with the Lord, and hearing and grasping and understanding that the promises of the covenant of grace are promises of empowerment and empowering us to walk with the Lord and to serve him and to do things beyond our natural ability, and indeed a power to give us enjoyment and satisfaction and a peace as we serve, a fulfillment as we serve. What is the service of God to us? We must constantly ask ourselves, because it will indicate what covenant you're in practice functioning under. When you see that our service of God isn't in order to be saved, it's to express our gratitude. It's to express our love. It's those works that Paul again refers to in Ephesians, in the very chapter where he speaks most and most clearly about the grace of God and being saved by God. He says, but we are ordained to good works before the world began. And of course, the motive will be one of gratitude and love. We'll find that yoke of Christ not a burden. And that's what he promised, isn't it? And look at the most happiest and contented of Christians. They're those that are engaged in the service of the Lord. And that's the way it should be. Gather the people. Read this law to them. Look down to verse 14. And the Lord said unto Moses, behold, thy days approach that thou must die. Call Joshua. Present yourselves in the tabernacle of the congregation, that I may give him a charge. Moses and Joshua went and presented themselves. And the Lord, verse 15, appeared in the tabernacle in a pillar of a cloud. And the pillar of the cloud stood over the door of the tabernacle. And the Lord said unto Moses, behold, thou shalt sleep with thy fathers. Just pause in that little euphemism for death. You're going to die. You'll sleep with your fathers. Well, they tell us there's no evidence in the Old Testament for resurrection or any hint of what happens at all when a person dies. You don't find it. Well, only if you're blind to phrases like this one. For it means much more than he's just going to die as his fathers before him. The euphemism for death is sleep. You'll sleep with your fathers. With reference to his body, it will go into the ground. But with regards to his conscious soul, he will be at rest. He will be with his fathers, the faithful that have gone before him, that are with the Lord himself, even back then. And of course, this is the intermediate state. But notice, and here was this reference to God declaring what the people would do, how they would live, how they would respond. The many. There's always the remnant. There's always the elect. And they will be faithful. They will prove God. They will suck the nourishment and the wonderful nourishment from the promises that are being given to Joshua and to the nation that is faithful. But notice, the rest, well, they shall go a-whoring after the gods of the strangers of the land, whither they go to be among them, and will forsake me, and break my covenant, which I have made with them. This is a covenant that is breakable. Indeed, it's not just breakable, it's bound to be broken, because the people can't keep it. They can't keep a covenant of works. They can't do what is required of them to procure and to keep the blessings of God. So God says they'll go. Here's the covenant. Here's my promises based on their faithfulness and their obedience. But I tell you now, they won't be faithful. They won't be obedient. Well, that's forewarning Joshua, of course, and indeed the faithful. And we need that even in our own time. We can't be discouraged when in these last days there are those departing the faith. When perhaps even more will depart the faith. And more as the days come. When, says Christ, because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold, and they will depart the faith. Well, that could be so discouraging if you're a true Christian. But to know that that's going to happen, for the Lord to tell us this will be the case, why, two things. It's forewarning us. It's saying, guard your heart. It's as the writer of Hebrews. And I just quote this so I get it exactly right. But you know the writer to the Hebrews, and they were being encouraged and enticed to turn from the true faith and to trusting in Christ, to go back to the law, to go back to the covenant of works. And in Hebrews 3, you have those words, 3 verse 12. Take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. Take heed, true Christians will. It's the warning, but it's also good to know our God knows everything. Everything's under his control. Joshua's being reminded of that. Don't be overly troubled and concerned, Joshua. and the faithful that will stand with you, and there always will be the remnant. But don't be overly discouraged when the people turn against you. When those that are unregenerate lose the blessings of God and bring judgment upon the nation because of their rebellion, their disobedience, their idolatry. Be aware of it. Know these things are going to happen and will come to pass, as indeed we ourselves, again, are forewarned. But look, if the world's getting any kind of a grip on your heart, if you're a professing Christian and you're being enticed and being ensnared, and the siren voices and your own deceitful heart is beginning to be tugged in a direction that will take you out of the will of God. And remember that quote. I think it's worth remembering. If you depart out of the will of God to get something that you really want to get, remember, you'll have to stay out of his will to keep hold of it. It's warning. It's challenge. It's information necessary for Joshua and the elect. Here's what they will do. And God then lays it out clearly and how he will respond as the holy God. Verse 17, then my anger shall be kindled against them in that day. That's when they break the covenant, when they turn from him. And I will forsake them, and I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured, and many evils and troubles shall befall them, so that they will say in that day, are not these evils come upon us because our God is not among us? Why even that's gracious, is it not? Some, in their waywardness, when the chastisement and judgment would fall upon the nation, would come to realize that they needed forgiveness and pardon, that these things came upon them because they had broken the covenant. Some would be moved, individuals, to seek God, to seek his pardon, to seek forgiveness, to be open to the receiving of the covenant of grace, a true relationship with the Lord Almighty. I wonder, are you open? Have you become a little more receptive to a covenant that says you can know God and you can walk with him and you know your service? And that's maybe what puts you off. I don't want to serve. I've got things to do. I've got things to explore. I've got things I want to enjoy. I'm only here. It's the only life I've got. It's a limited time. I want to live and experience things. And that's what prevents you from genuinely seeking the Lord and a relationship with him that is transforming. Well, then consider, there would be some when the crisis comes who would be awakened, who would turn to God, who would earnestly seek him, who would then discover that service wasn't that burdensome, onerous experience that in their unconverted state they were led to believe, or they thought, that they would have life, that there would be joy, that out of gratitude to the God that gave himself for them, they would find joy and delight. They would discover wondrous things about their God and about their their Savior as they went about their service. Don't be conned by this world. Don't be duped by your deceitful heart. It is desperately wicked. It does say to us, does it not? It's the end of life to walk with God. It's the end of life to talk about serving God. That smacks of work, 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 burden, burden, burden. It isn't that. It is far from that. To know him is to love him. To love him is to want to please him. To seek his grace, to seek the power, to seek transformation, to seek the end of self that's been on the throne of life from the day we're born. Replace it with the Savior. Let's sing our closing hymn. 428. The hymn 428. Grace, 'tis a charming